This is Mental Selling. This is the sales podcast for people that are dedicated to making a difference in customers' lives and have a purpose beyond just a paycheck. I'm your host, Will Milano. Let's get right into the show. Customer relationships are based on conversations and authentic connections, not transactions. And yet, so many organizations struggle to create brand conversations that get more customers to the table and actually convert. A sales organization's brand definition of their ideal target audience matters more than you think. But how do you combine that with a clear, compelling message that gets you in front of the right buyers at the right time? And why is having a clear and formulaic brand message so critical to reaching, engaging, and serving your prospects and customers? To discuss these issues today on Mental Selling, your favorite sales podcast, I'm very excited to be joined by Kate DeLeo. Kate is CEO and founder of The Brand Trifecta, and she is best-selling author of Muting the Megaphone. As her website says, her focus is on building brands that win more work. Kate, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Will. I'm excited to talk about brand and messaging and all of the things today related to sales.
I'm very excited about it as well. For listeners, I happened to meet Kate just a couple of months ago at the annual Content Marketing World Conference, which was in Washington, D.C. I saw you speak there, and I knew immediately that I wanted to talk to you and have you on this podcast.
I'm happy to be here. Let's do this.
Let's start with a broad question, but I think something that sets us up for the rest of the discussion today. What's the role and importance of brand in driving revenue? How should organizations be thinking about it differently? And why do you think salespeople and some sales leaders, they still think of brand as some nebulous, nice-to-have marketing thing, but something that's not actually tied to the growth of the business?
First of all, you're hitting on something that's so true, which is that when we hear this word brand, it just sounds so fluffy, doesn't it? Oh, it's the color purple. Well, hang on. What is brand? I think at our core, your brand is the promise of who you are and the value you deliver to your customers, clients, partners, et cetera, about the promise. And how that shows up for an organization is not only through the visual side of things like logo, colors, all the pretty stuff, but actual message, written or verbal or otherwise, that you deliver to your prospects and customers. So said differently, it is really the messaging of speaking to somebody to say, this is what we do. This is how we solve your problem. This is how we're different than the competition. And when we logically think about that, brand, if that's what brand is, brand has the power to be the path of least resistance to revenue because it should back into who we're serving and why, a message that deeply speaks to that heart pain that we solve for our customers. So ultimately, revenue depends on having a brand that is surgical, that's refined. And I'll tell you, a brand that is not just sitting in some document, that is not just owned by marketing, but that is the message that sales themselves live and breathe and speak every day, that it feels like authentic to this is who we are.
Beyond the message, it's also the behaviors that people have to back it up and how they show up in the room every single day.
That's such an interesting point you make, because I had a client a few years ago and they said, can't we be aspirational with what we say in our brand? And I said, no, you cannot. Brand is not aspirational. Brand is really about here and now and what you can deliver on. So that's a great thing as an organization to say strategically, we want to be here in 5 years, or we want to become the global ABC. And I say, that's wonderful. But in order to get to that point, you need to build demand for that. And in order to build demand, you got to be really great at owning who you are in the here and now and have the ability to deliver on that promise you're putting into the world. Otherwise, what happens is marketing, and listen, I'm a marketer, marketing goes right in one message, sales says a totally different message, and the poor customer delivery team or the product team or operations teams are going, we can't even fulfill that. Now we've got bad reputation and everybody's angry and we're losing loyalty and losing customer base, etc.
It's that idea of you're creating a promise. You better be able to back it up. That's why everybody has to sing from the same song sheet. And we're going to get into this, but I think a lot of what you're alluding, that brand and that message has to be really concise to be compelling. The days of the 90 or 120 second elevator speech are over.
So I call my book Muting the Megaphone because I realized, like, in today's market, we are just inundated with megaphone marketing. When you think about it, like, these long spiels, these big sales funnel pages, you're like, I don't know what button to click. I have 15 paragraphs I'm supposed to read. Like, we are inundated with too much as consumers. And if we just go back to basics for a second, let's put our sales hat on, our old school business development hat, and we think about a general conversation. We should be able to, in that first 15 to 30 seconds of speaking with somebody, really know if there's going to be a value add and an opportunity here to go deeper into the weeds or not. We're either on the same page or we aren't. So what that means is that our message of what we say and speak and think and what we write should be short enough and crisp enough that somebody quickly on the other end of that conversation gets it and goes, now that's interesting. I want to go deeper in that conversation, learn more, understand what it costs, what does it look like?
If you put a timer on that, on what speaking for even 60 seconds is, that's a long time. And nobody's got the patience for that.
I think I shared this with you at Content Marketing World. My career, I actually had no intention of going into branding. What happened for me is I was planning to do this PhD in linguistic anthropology. So what happened was is the market crash back in 2008, if you guys recall. At that time, as I was pursuing my postgraduate studies, I had a professor just say, listen, I actually think that you have no chance of getting a professorship and you should leave and go get a job and pay off your undergraduate debt. Because of that, I actually left academia and I had to go get a sales job. I didn't have experience. So my whole career started in sales and I love sales, but here's why this is matters. It was in that sales job, they throw you to the wolves. Here's all your scripts. Here's your email scripts. We're going to give you a database of 10,000 leads. Go smile and dial 40 to 60 dials a day. We're going to sign up your database to these drip marketing campaigns through our system. Have fun. Their scripts sucked. And I was like spewing on these poor people. Cold calling an IT professional, by the way. I had to cold call IT professionals, Will, to sell them $2,500 training classes. No IT person wants to be called, let alone sold to. So I was like basically shooting myself in the foot with this job. You know what I realized the power of short and crisp, and I didn't even know this was a brand pitch at the time, is I had to throw out their scripts and I was like, hold on, reverse engineer this. If I were on the other end of this phone, what the heck would I want to know in the first 15 seconds to remotely want to have a conversation? I had to boil it down to hitting on the one, two, three that I now teach for a brand pitch, which I didn't know was a brand pitch, which is, hi, my name's Kate. This is what we do. This is how we can solve your problem. This is how we're different. Boom. And then shut up. By the way, it worked. It worked. I ended up successfully running over $1 million a year in quota and being over 100%.
It starts from having that outside in customer perspective versus what do I want to say? And instead of that, it's what do they want to hear? And it's a subtle distinction, but it's one that a lot of people don't think about.
What I stumbled upon and I didn't know, I didn't even know this was brand. I didn't know this was marketing. I just knew that this was like, hi, my name's Kate and I need to keep my job. So what do I say to get somebody to want to talk and have a sales conversation is psychologically as humans, we don't care about somebody's products or services yet, the actual thing, until we understand at a high level, crisply, tell me what you do. Tell me how you could solve my actual problem in general, and then how are you different from others who have given that promise before? That really is the one, two, three punch that I call the brand trifecta. And there's certain brand statements we can talk about of what that means. But when somebody hears that, then they're at a conversion moment where they want to go deeper, Will, into the conversation and learn about the thing we're selling.
Can be so easy for a salesperson that they've got genuine excitement about what they have to offer. But because of that, it forces them, they jump the gun into wanting to talk about the me, I stuff that, like you said, until you get breakthrough with that message, nobody cares.
Nobody cares. And what's so cool is it's really okay. It's really okay if we think about it as a salesperson, because what we're recognizing is that by simply giving folks those three big things that they need in the beginning, they're going to self-select in. They're going to opt in if they're our ideal target audience and if they hear value in what we're saying. And that's a beautiful moment because what it just did is it got the monkey off of our back from pushing into being in a position where we're leading from invitation and not desperation, where all of a sudden it actually becomes a value-adding conversation where that customer's going, I do actually want to know more. I do want to know how much it costs, what's included, how does it work, all the details that we'd love to unpack as the salesperson, as a part of our process. And it's just recognizing that a great brand pitch at the beginning allows this interesting conversation to happen, whether it's internal when somebody's reading it on your website or that you're actually calling and speaking to somebody, it allows them to opt in And we don't have to be that slimy salesperson anymore.
Let's talk about the psychology of today's buyers. What gets customers' attention to the point that they'll agree to a conversation, and what do they ultimately want from salespeople today?
Ultimately, what catches a customer's attention or prospect's attention in the beginnings of any brand pitch are two things. It's a really strong, and I'm going to talk now, bear with me, I'm going to talk about language for a second, an actual structure. The two most important things you have to have is a strong tagline, 5 to 6 word phrase that says, this is what we do. We blank, we tagline. Let me give you an example. If you, Will and I are talking and Will says, oh, so nice to meet you. What's the first thing you're going to ask me? What do you do? And if I just sit there and say, I do marketing or branding, is that very compelling?
No, you're not going to say, tell me more about that.
But if I say to you, I help build brands that win work, or I create messaging that delivers revenue results.
Then it goes to, oh, tell me, what do you mean by that?
What do you mean by that? So I got to catch them immediately with your response to what do you do, your tagline as an individual or a company. It's got to provoke the what do you mean by that moment. And then that follows into the second piece, Will, which is the follow-up to that. If they ask you, interesting, what do you mean by that, is what we call a value proposition statement. So in marketing terms, what that means is it's the big, bold, audacious one or two sentences that speaks to the heart pain that individual is feeling. It basically explains your tagline. So it's saying, well, what I mean by that, Will, is the reality is this, and here's how you can solve that. It's the sentence and everything that, have you ever had that, oh my God, you get me moment? It's the you get me moment. In a matter of three sentences, I'm giving somebody you get me moment. That's what our buyers need before they're like, yeah, okay, are you like these competitors? How does this work? What does this look like? All the things.
The you get me moment doesn't necessarily have to be about like a stated need. It's just that sort of credibility of this person understands my life.
Correct. It's highly emotional. This is interesting. When we talk about a strong value proposition statement, I'll give you a silly example here. Let's assume it's a tax company. I provide tax services. Let's say you're my ideal target audience. You are a very busy small business owner who has a lot on your plate, and you're trying to make sure you've got your taxes and compliance figured out. But up till now, it's just been very haphazard. It takes a lot of your time. So let's assume I say, hey, you ask me, Kate, what do you do? And I give you my tagline, which is, we help make compliance effortless for small businesses. And you're like, that's interesting, because it's not effortless for me. So I give you my value prep. Here's the you get me moment. You say, what do you mean by that? And I go, well, the reality is, tax is a major part of your business, but it should not be a major part of your day. That's where we come in. We're going to help you protect your credibility and your relationships and your profits with worry-free. What I did is I explained what I meant, but did you hear how emotional that was? Actually, whenever I give that example to business owners or CFOs, they're like, oh my God, give me these people's number, because that's exactly the hell that I'm in every quarter. It's emotional. I spoke to the need and not the things I do.
There's got to be that hierarchy and consistency, because you've got to have a repeatable message, because you've got to repeat it. It's got to be simple, because one of the things we talk about with brands is they've got to be simple enough so that people remember them. And if you see these emails that salespeople send and they're like 3-4 paragraphs long, and somewhere in there might be something interesting, but good luck finding it. If it requires 8, 10, 12, 15 touch points to get somebody's attention and get them to respond back to you, they better be seeing the same simple, compelling message over and over again. That's why advertising exists.
The message that we're talking about should be the same message that is at the crux of face-to-face, Zoom calls. Are you showing up in CEO mastermind groups to get your leads? Or are you cold calling? Are you using email marketing? What about advertising, social? All of the tactics are all great tactics that you could or could not use for your company. Maybe you're showing up at conferences and industry events. Totally fine. If the message is off between what you say in an ad or on your website versus what the salesperson said in the room face to face, how do you think that's going to go over with the prospect? We don't even realize we're doing it, because often there's this silo situation between sales and marketing. And one of the biggest things that I talk about is, as a sales leader, we have a responsibility to align and get in the sandbox with marketing and with core leadership to make sure that we're all working from the same message. Period. Full stop. I'll tell you, that can feel scary for both sides. Why? for sales, we know there's an art and science to this. We know it's personal. We love the fact that we need to show up and build a relationship and adjust depending on the other person. I'm not saying we lose that, but we cannot be such a chameleon that we say different things every single time, or we are going to actually create confusion in the marketplace.
And that doesn't mean that you don't segment your message based on different target audiences. You've got to massage things a bit based on what function that person is in, because again, most companies have multiple target audiences.
Yeah. Can I give you an example of that? I've got a couple clients that they sell SaaS products. Their particular sales process is a series of discovery calls. They do outbound email, cold outreach. They get on a discovery call and then they go through the close process. Let's say that's the process for sales for this particular organization. Their ideal buyers, one of them had a CEO, a head of marketing, and then the head of finance. Now, obviously, those are three different messages, aren't they? Think about the needs of those particular roles. So what does that mean for messaging and branding, et cetera? What the team did, we built what we call the core main tagline and value prop of here for everybody, this is what we do and solve for. And then they built audience specific value proposition statements and slogans or taglines so that they could actually click on a page that says, are you a marketer? Are you a sales leader? Are you whatever? And they could go into that specific page and have that next layer down of messaging for that CFO or that sales leader or marketer goes, this makes sense for my role and function. Thank you.
Why does focusing on your ideal target audience, let's get into that a bit. Why does that versus the like, oh, but we can help everyone with everything or everyone's a prospect, that sort of thing. Why does taking the sort of time and diligence to focus on the ideal target audience matter so much today? How do you actually go about defining and sticking to who those ideal client profiles are? Especially, it can be hard because if you're a salesperson, you hit those inevitable valleys and pressure ratchets up to bring in more deals. That can be tempting to have that stuff go by the wayside.
Oh my gosh, of course. And I think we all feel that pressure sometimes of, if we're not selling, we're not selling. What do we do? I think first of all, at a core organizational level, when we talk about target audiences, who are we going after and why? That is part of brand. That actually dictates the message you write and say and speak and all the things. Now, the rule of thumb is this. For organizations in general, you have to remember that you cannot speak to everybody. Technically speaking, everybody could find value in what you do. Technically speaking, you can help everybody. Technically speaking, not everybody's going to buy from you. The rule of thumb is what I call the 70-30 split. And it's a principle of recognizing that as an organization, our job is to try to find the one or two or three, maybe four top target audiences that make up the majority or 70% of where we want revenue to come from, with an acknowledgement that we're going to have these outlier audiences over here that make up the 30%. And they may be people that found you, referrals. Maybe it's clients that you used to serve really well and they're a pain in the butt, but you have some legacy clients that are not ideal anymore. One fintech company said we had a generation of boomers that were no longer serving you, and now we're going for Gen Xers. So you may have some phase out of who used to be ideal and you're growing through that. Allow those 30% to be over here. They love you, they find you, but are you actively messaging and marketing to them? Nope. You're actively going after the ones that have the highest probability of buying and will most deeply resonate with your message and will be the fastest yes. And this is imperative to protect our bottom line and our sales team's efforts. We've got to be able to decide. The bottom line is that you are not in the business of convincing. You are in the business of converting. And when we're spending time trying to convince an unqualified or decent prospect to purchase, we are losing time going after the right ones that are going to say yes faster.
There's so many people out there that get and believe with what your message is that you don't need to spend time trying to preach and convert people that are like, I'm not sure I buy that. Don't waste your time on those. There's so many out there that will nod their head if you have that compelling message because in their hearts, they buy into what you have to say.
Do you know what's interesting too? Your ideal buyers can smell it a mile away if you're just trying to serve and solve for everybody or if you actually have the confidence to stay in your lane and know who you are and who you serve best. When as a brand and as an organization, and as a sales team and as a marketing team and as a leadership team, we own who we are and what we do. We have this confidence of saying, this is exactly who we are, what we do. This is who we help. These are the problems we solve. And this is how we're different. The right buyers go, I love that. That's so what I want. That's why I want this group versus that group. It means, though, we have got to stop worrying about the competition at a certain point, and we've got to stop have this fear of missing out. Meaning, If your competition is doing great over here and they're in a sea of blue and green, stop trying to copy what they're doing to get market share, because you're just going to be blue and green in a sea of blue and green. Go be audaciously red or orange.
Or worrying about where the competition is showing up. If they're doing this, maybe we should do that. Who cares?
Who cares? You have buyers that don't go where your competition goes. Your job is to acquire them. That's the goal here. They already don't like the competition. So if you put that logic hat on, you want to go get the ones that are not even remotely interested in your competition. This is not about stealing market share. It's about gaining market share. And that means you've got to actually find ones that are going to have been waiting for you to show up as who you are so they can buy.
In 99% of businesses, your ability as an organization or as a salesperson to hit your growth goals, whatever those may be, you're not dealing with a pie. Your slice of the pie is not dependent on decreasing somebody else's size. There's a large enough playground to play in that you can hit your goals regardless of what your competitors are doing.
Exactly. You know who did a good job at this? This is so fascinating. I work with both B2B and B2C brands. These rules that we're talking about actually apply to both scenarios. I've worked with e-com companies where same rules apply. Now, this is so funny. You talk about market share for a second. Do you know who was really good at niching in and then growing market share? Facebook. So if we rewind back to 2004, I was a freshman in college. Freshman in college, I was at the University of Minnesota, and it was so fascinating. So what happened was, is at that time, Facebook had been beta launched to certain universities, and we all got an email that said, congratulations, you can join this thing called Facebook, but you must log in using your .edu email address. Do you even remember this? You had to have a .edu email address to even join Facebook. Now, they did such a good job building Facebook for colleges that the demand grew, and much to my dismay, 2 years later, my mother joined Facebook and my life was over. Or it was 3 years, I don't even remember, right? But then all of a sudden, there was demand. So then they expanded based on the demand from an ancillary target audience they were not even going after, Will. Then the age range went from 18 down to 16. Then they tried lowering it below 16, and there was this big hubbubaloo, so they had to bring it up to 16 again. Do you see what happened? Is they went in their lane, and it was only when the demand was there that they were like, oop, boop, now we can talk to more people with different brand messaging. Boop, now we can shift, and they're coming in ready for us. That's a different sales approach.
And if you're true to that target audience, is probably really a rich and robust enough group. Take a lot of your time and effort, quite a while before you need to expand it from there.
100%. Think about the budget they had to do it so quickly. Most of us, when we think about market share and gaining and really growing our target audiences, we're talking years and years here. And that is okay. Our revenue and our bottom line depend on our ability to stay close to who we are and who we really think we should be going after.
Let's talk a little bit more about the focus on aligning around a singular message and this idea of less is more, because you touched on it earlier, but it's still something that salespeople especially will really struggle with maintaining the discipline around, is that idea of saying less is more, that you don't need to get on a customer call that's a 40-minute call and try to squeeze in 35 PowerPoint slides, that you don't have to do prospecting messages that are four paragraphs long. How do you create that discipline? I don't know what the term would be for it, just that the buy-in around less is more.
I think it's helping sales understand that if we have a singular brand message, let's say I built this amazing tagline and value proposition statement and differentiator statements, which is really the crux of the first line of defense of any brand. Now, by the way, that's not paragraphs of copy. We're talking like single sentences. This is a very minimal copy on a homepage, a website. And let's say you are emailing and you've got very short emails that speak to the same pieces. And let's say somebody finds you or hears about you, or you met them at an event and they go stalk your website. Why is this so important? Because if we break it down, you want to hold a discovery call. If that message is clear and it's short and it's concise and you're willing to stick to it, you're getting yourself out of convincing land and you're staying in converting land. Now, how does that look? Instead of that prospect getting on a 45-minute discovery call asking you, what do you do? They already know that. You already gave it to them. They already know how you can solve their problem. How does that help sales? By the time they get on that call, they've self-selected in. So instead of you having to repeat all that for the first 10 slides of your discovery call, the conversation shifts and they're starting to go, so I saw what you said and we're dealing with this specific issue. Can you solve that? And how much does that cost? That is a very different step in the process. So what we find is that your ability in that discovery call to shift gears a little bit and to start to lead in with the question is, did you have a chance to look at our website? Yeah, I did. I loved what you said. What's going on? Why are we on this call today? What's going on for you? That's beautiful. This opens up a different door for allowing them to go into the weeds that you can scope and price very quickly. That's why it's so critical. The discipline that we have to remember is not trying to say everything. Brand is about self-selection. So for sales, we've got to stick with the script. If we don't, we're going to be vomiting on people that did not self-select in, and then we're going to lose them.
I want to go back to the brand trifecta and go a little bit even deeper on that about, again, you're talking about something that should be communicated and delivers impact in the first, you said, less than 30 seconds of any sales conversation. It's tagline, value proposition statement, and differentiator statements, and how you come up with those.
Let's go back to that silly example around tax. Could we use that for an example? And I always use this back and forth discussion as, imagine having a sales conversation. So I told you my amazing tagline, which is what I do. We make compliance effortless. And you're like, wow, that's interesting. What do you mean by that? And I deliver my sassy, amazing value prop, whether you like it or not, which is, well, tax is a major priority for your business, but it doesn't need to be a major part of your day. Protect your credibility, relationships, and profits with worry-free tax consulting. Here's what we can't miss. That's the first two parts of your brand trifecta, tagline, value prop. Most of us logically as sales would immediately, you're ready to know about my amazing tax services. Think about it. Aren't we ready to talk about the services at that point? I told you that they can solve your problem. Obviously, we should be able to go right in. You're so ready to know about my tax services. But this is incorrect, and this is what we cannot miss as sales leaders. We can't deviate from the script. Will, you are not actually ready to know about my tax services yet until I deliver my third piece called differentiator statements. But why is that? So here's the psychology behind this. Differentiators are just the 1, 2, 3 big bullet points of how you're different and better than the rest, by the way. And they are things like speed, efficiency, maybe price, although I don't think people want to play that game. Maybe it is proprietary process or approach. Maybe it's things like technology platform, your tech, or your data. You cannot just say your people. Our people are great. Everybody's people are great. So unless you can prove that a different way, let's move away from that one. But what are the big things, apples to apples, that somebody compares you against another competitor? Why would they choose you? Why does this matter? Imagine I delivered my tagline and value prop to you, Will, and we're in this conversation. You're like, that's interesting. What do you mean by that? And I tell you my value prop. Your poor brain sitting there is probably going, I got to make sense of what Kate just told me. I've heard something similar before. I need to make sure I'm tracking with her. So do you know what the brain does when it takes in new data or information it's never heard before? It makes a comparison. Your brain actually tries to compartmentalize new information into a compartment or a category that it already has. So said differently, what's going to happen is you heard this compelling start of my brand pitch from me, and you're like, I need to make sense of this. So you're going to actually compare me to the competition that you already know. And you know how this happens in a conversation every time when all of a sudden you look at me, Will, and you go, so Kate, are you like H&R Block or TurboTax or one of the big four tax companies? By the way, when you do that comparison moment, you set me up beautifully to deliver my third piece. I go, oh my gosh, I'm a little different. This is the moment we're waiting for. This is why this is so important that you can't deviate from the script and you have to deliver the third piece of the trifecta. Is because finally, at the end of that is the conversion moment when Will, you go, that's interesting. That makes sense. So Kate, so how does that work? Or what does that look like? How does that work? What does that look like? Okay. Ding, ding. When a prospect is asking a how, what question, congratulations. What they're signaling is the psychology of now they're ready to go. Tell me how you deliver on that promise. What's included? What's the price? What do I get? How long does it take? On a website, it's literally where they click to go and watch your explainer video or go to your products or services page, like clockwork. But here's the bottom line. This is why this is so important with the brand trifecta and why you don't deviate, is until you hear those three points, you don't care about the how, what, the thing yet. That's why this makes sense for sales and it's so critical.
The other part of the differentiator piece, I'm sure you've seen this a lot. Differentiator is not, we've been in business X number of years. here's a nice splashy PowerPoint slide with prominent client logos, or we've got locations in X number of countries. That's not, nobody cares, because it's not differentiated, because by definition, every other company that you're going against can put some version of that up on the screen.
Let's say for the tax company, maybe they're highly agile. They actually, as a team, get answers to you within 24 hours. Maybe they are investigators where they say, we will go into the weeds for you so you don't have to think about it. We're going to go look at the latest tax laws, and we're going to come up proactively serving up those latest tax laws for you. Maybe it's proactivity. Maybe it's agility. Maybe it's the communication styles. Maybe it is the fact that compared to your competitors, yours, you guys are the only one with this amazing reporting and dashboard and flow of what you deliver. I want you to think about what your customers have said about you. Why did they choose you over the competition? Go collect some of that feedback here, because that's the stuff that you want to hone in on. And there might be 50 reasons and 50 features and benefits and 50 ways that you help. But what we're talking about for differentiators is, what's the macro level sum of those parts? What's the 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 or 5 ways that you truly are better than the competition?
Next thing I want to ask you about is, how can salespeople shift their mindset more toward thinking of themselves as value creators and relationship builders and not product pushers? It's a big mindset shift, whether you're a new salesperson or highly experienced, need to come to grips with, isn't it?
I think all of us as leaders and as sales leaders, we have to mature into, how is this not about pushing? How do I make this not about the quota? How do I make this about human capacity? And I think the biggest thing that we have to remember here is, sales leaders who have matured into this place where they see really strong close ratios, they take this old school Rolodex approach. Fascinating is, the best sales folks that I've ever seen know the people they've called, and they keep in touch with the people they've called, and they actually have a Rolodex. Remember those things? They treat people as humans first, not leads. I think we need to really get back to basics here of, if I'm having a conversation with another human and I just get to that point, what do I say? How do I have a value-adding human conversation?
How do I make sure that this, whatever it is, 5 minutes, 20, 30 minutes is worth their time?
People know whether you care. People are smart enough to close themselves when they know you care. People buy from people. And brand is human first and foremost. And when your message is on point, you have the ability, when you deliver that pitch, to create a human connection that opens the door for you to do what you do best, the art and science of sales, and do it in a way that is a two-way conversation, value-adding, higher close ratio, better speed, the things that you look for. And on the other side, that customer, that human, is going to get the best possible product and feel extremely excited about that. That's the magic.
What do you see as the best ways to get salespeople to approach prospecting with both the right technique and the right mindset? Because prospecting is, I think, a big mindset thing. That, do you feel like you're interrupting people, bothering people? Is it cringy what you're doing? Or are you excited to do it because you know you've got something that can help that other person and help them solve a problem? So when it comes to prospecting, what do you see as the best approaches, technique, and mindset? And also, are there pitfalls or any wrong assumptions around prospecting to be avoided?
I think the biggest thing is coming in from a place of, how do we help? So I had a team actually test this out. And again, now keep in mind, I'm a small business. My approach to building my own business as the entrepreneur and the founder was, I needed to be out building relationships and ultimately get on sales conversations to close. So I really prioritized building my network. So the first thing is, you have to build an actual network. As a salesperson, you do not just have a leads list, you have a network. You have a network of people that you like as humans at other companies. And you got to start thinking about, how do I create relationships or partnerships where I could be lead sharing with other great humans that I like and trust? Even if you're just a sales associate, I want you to think about, if I were the owner of this company, what would I be doing to go close deals? That's first and foremost. And the second thing is, what do you say when you show up in the conversation? The number one thing that I always ask, and is in every email, is, I love what you're doing. I want to know more. Happy to share about what we're doing. I think there's some points of synergy, and I'd love to see how we can advocate for each other. I've never had somebody say no to that. So at the end of every sales call, I go, here's the deal. Whether this is a fit for you or not, how can I help you? Who do you need to know? Are there introductions I can make? I've never had a no to that. What's amazing is, when you ask that, they're going to ask the same thing back to you. And you know what you get to say is, if you know somebody that's dealing with this or this, that's a great introduction. Here's a great partnership. That's how you build that Rolodex. And all of a sudden, they're going to have you in mind as a solution provider when they come across somebody in their network that needs what you have. We have to remember that every lead that we talk to is a human. They may not actually be a customer, but if we don't treat them like a human, they're not going to be advocate for us. They could be the person that you don't know sends the perfect referral. And you're shooting yourself in the foot if you don't treat them as a human, as a part of your network.
It's a great perspective to think of yourself as a networker. And again, think of, I don't have leads. I've got a network that I'm continuing to foster and build. And that idea that you can and should be brokering introductions for that customer prospect just as much as you want to ideally get them from them. The way you position that was you can get referrals from people that haven't even bought from you yet, or maybe never will. Your referrals don't just have to be come from your sort of longest standing, best love.
Most of my 90% or more come from just great people in my network that I stay in touch with.
As you said, as a result of you offering first to connect them with other people or organizations that might help them before you're even asking. It's a great way to flip that script around referrals, which can be a big scary thing for salespeople too, right? Very often afraid to be asking for referrals unless it's like their best of the best client that's worked with them for 20 years.
When I went into college to be linguistic anthropology, it was the best advice I ever got from my dad. He said, you can study anything you want, Kate, but there's three rules in life. Never burn a bridge. You live and die by your Rolodex, and you better know how to sell something. And my friend, that has served me well, and especially those first two, because that's the ultimate sales right there, is don't burn a bridge. Live and die by the relationships and network that you make. And when you do that, delivering the pitch comes easy. Showing up in the room authentically comes easy. Being a human first and helping first comes easy. And all of a sudden, our ability to close and hit the quotas and hit the revenue, it feels so much better and so much easier. And we gain this momentum and this joy around selling that ultimately that's what we want in this profession.
This has really been great, Kate. Thank you so much for being with us. And I think you can see, and I think the listeners can understand now why I wanted to have you on the show. Because we talk about, again, all of these mental and motivational and emotional drivers of sales. And everything that we've talked about today is exactly on point with that. So thank you again for taking time to add a lot of value to this show.
Thank you so much for having me, Will. I really appreciate this. This has been a ton of fun.
For our listeners, you can find and follow Kate DeLeo on both LinkedIn and Instagram. Her website is katedeleo.com. That's Kate, DILEO.com. And the link to her LinkedIn profile will be in the show notes. And again, her best-selling book is called Muting the Megaphone. Thank you to everybody for listening. Again, as always, from wherever and whenever you might be hearing this, please leave us a review or rating or comment. We love all the feedback that we get to help us make this show better. And of course, please tell a colleague or a friend or two about us. Go back and catch up on any recent episodes you might have missed. And thanks for joining us. And we'll look forward to having you be with us on our next episode. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for listening. And I really hope you've enjoyed this episode of Mental Selling. Please make sure that you're subscribed, and as always, leave us a comment or a rating. Share it with your networks. You'll get more content like this on our website at integritysolutions.com. Until next time, I'm Will Milano with Integrity Solutions. Thanks very much again for being with us.